composer and band leader Kenny Dorham on trumpet opening Aphrodisia on his 5-star album Afro-Cuban. It was first released in 1955 as a 10-inch vinyl record, and then it was updated many times after that. Although acclaimed for his prowess as a composer, band leader, and general fantastic musician for his prolific performances as a jazz, bebop, and hard bop trumpeter, Kenny Dorham, nonetheless, is often acknowledged as one of the most underrated musicians. He really never did get the recognition he deserved before his death from kidney disease in 1972. He was only 48 years old. But when you're that good, you last a long time, and your work speaks for you over the years, even if you're no longer with us. That's the lesson of Kenny Dorham. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. Now, what do we do with Free Your Mind Friday? It is, for those of you joining us perhaps for the first time, this is our open forum. You can discuss issues that you think are important and discuss it from your unique perspective, your unique point of view. So a good, strong opinion about something is really a necessary part of our discussions when we have Free Your Mind Friday. We are a bunch of very friendly people, and we have good manners, and we're interested really in exchanging information, opinions, and ideas. And the thought is that when we, part of what we have to do really is to educate each other, and we do that through conversations and exchanges with each other. So that's the purpose of Free Your Mind Friday. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And I'm looking for conversations. Don't just, call in and say your two, cents worth and disappear. But put on the table for us things that we might consider and extend a conversation about, because you put the ideas before us in such a way that we can react to them. We're looking for conversations to come out of what it is you present to us. So people are free to agree or disagree or further comment on your offering. That's the whole point. All right. It's not that here's an open forum and you get on the air and you say your two cents and then you're done. No, we're not trying to just be, a program where people just do that. That doesn't have nearly as much value as presenting an idea that warrants further discussion and debate. So 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And we are looking to engage each other in conversation. You don't have to agree. That's the beauty of it. There's no right or wrong in your opinion. Your opinion is your opinion. But what we should be able to appreciate is that your opinion is drawn from a considerable exploration of the subject, so that you have a particular point of view, which you can defend if it comes to that, but that the legitimacy of your ideas are the fodder that keeps stoking the conversation, keeping it alive. Let's start with Randolph from Montreal. Hello, Randolph. You're on the air.
Hello, Leatrice. I was saddened yesterday when some callers suggested that the border between Canada and the United States is reinforced with sort of armed people. I'd like to say that a border, a barrier, a wall, it keeps people out. That's true. But by the same token, it also keeps people in. And I don't know if the American people want to live in an outdoor prison like as is happening in Israel. So I'm saddened about that because Canada has generally helped those who protested in the United States from the beginnings of the United States, the black people, about 3,000 of them, came to Canada through some type of railway or something of that nature. And the Indian people who were mistreated, the Indians who were sadly mistreated, some even came to Canada for refuge. And even in the Vietnam War, Americans came to Canada. And the Canadians are taking in people from Syria who they have nothing at all to do with. Our neighbor to the south is the one that's responsible for the nonsense that's going on. So I don't know why people would want to do that. So I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, I'm not understanding the essential point of your argument.
The essential point is that Canada is a threat to the United States. They have to have a barrier. But what I'm saying is that by having the barrier, the people themselves are closing themselves out, and future administrations could, in other words, imprison people and not allow them to go out. I know it sounds crazy. I know it sounds strange, but it happens. It's happening. So I think this is really sad.
Well, it is a reflection of the kind of paranoia that existed prior to the official formation of the respective countries. Certainly when the so-called founding fathers found their way to the United States, they came perhaps from partitioned societies. And that's what they were accustomed to. You know, they came out of a history of fiefdoms, of kingdoms, which involved hard barriers and walls that closed people in as a form of protection. Everybody who owned a fiefdom or a kingdom or some other kind of dumb, they reinforced the notion by building fortresses and fortifications, closing in everything that was important to continued survival, including manufacturing and production of essential services and all of that. Those people, vital to the continuation of a kingdom, were closed in because that's the way it was. They were essentially owned. They were vassals of the local power in that region. So they are accustomed to the idea of walls. They're accustomed to the idea of erecting barriers because they also were accustomed to war. The exact opposite, in a way, you could look at in other societies where people recognize their boundaries, not by building walls or barriers, but by respecting treaties. And they worked things out that way because they found out, for example, a river, you can't, you know, put a wall on a river. If the river is necessary to sustain life, the river flows. And what would keep peace in the land is that we have some basic things that we agree on and we commit ourselves to just observing these rules by which we will live. So entirely different ideas about walls and barriers, two different approaches.
Sure.
In modern life, the United States has taken on this issue of walls and barriers, and you're correct. They're not only keeping people out, but they don't realize they're also keeping people in. And that is because essentially the relationships that the United States has forged with its neighbors is crude and elemental and full of distrust and a notion about this is ours and don't mess with it because we are dedicated to protecting it with our lives, which means war. It's just an entirely different mentality. So I would say that that, in part, is the mentality that was imported. They come from societies in which what you have is gained through war. A lot of it is gained through war. And the psychological need to protect it is expressed in the erection of war, of barriers or walls.
Sure.
So we haven't gone beyond that. And the question is whether we are even capable of going beyond that. You mentioned the fact that the indigenous people driven from their lands in the south and west of the United States, that's called the Trail of Tears, and they journeyed to Canada. There were no walls because they owned all of the land. They and their brothers and sisters and other affiliated groups had a history of dealing with each other. So they didn't need walls, although they were very clear that we settled this area over here. This is assigned to us by treaty and mutual recognition. Mm-hmm. But we don't have walls. The concept was so bizarre. But in Britain and in Europe, it was absolutely commonplace. Every little village had walls.
Right.
To defend itself from inevitable attack. But you're right. The walls may have made people believe that they're safe from attack from the outside, but it also closed them in. That's a lesson the United States has yet to understand. Thanks, Randolph, for getting us started today. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello, David.
I'm going to follow up on what you asked us for in the beginning to make something of this. I see this somewhat differently. The way I see this in terms of what Trump does, you know, with the people coming in for through Mexico for asylum and things like that, is his ability to be like a master musician playing a Stradivarius violin. Mr. Trump is very skillful in getting the people's attention to where he wants it to go. The mass of the people in this country are easily manipulated around, for example, European phenotype white supremacy, and around the proliferation of people of color, the emphasis on foreign entities that are selling things to the United States. And to me, all of this behavior is an attempt to get people's attention away from the real issue here, which is the ruling class is more and more successful in instituting their neoliberal policies of turning everything to private ownership for private profit. All instruments of government essentially will pre-privatize at this whatever level, state or local or national, and putting more and more money into private hands. That's the end game here. Enriching the rich that really run the government even more. They never have enough. And making the people poorer and poorer. And it seems to me this is working very well, because we have a large number of poor people and people are getting poorer. I know people who have PhD degrees and are poor, as well as, you know, people who have masters. And I know people who work as in fast food places and they have baccalaureates. So the point is that you get people's attention on all these issues like the immigrants, this crazy idea of building a $25 billion wall and all those things, and get their attention away from the real issue, which is manipulating the whole country, the voting system. All the levers that they can manage, they get away from any criticism of those people at the top who are just making out as fantastic bandits. They are going to do everything they can in the world to impoverish all the masses of people who live there to enhance their own wealth. And that's the issue that I see. It's not just
I think you're absolutely on point there. The thing, though, is that for all of their brilliant plans, and these issues fit neatly into their plans, for example, this issue with the border wall, it was intended that it would last, you know, they would milk it for at least up until the next presidential election. And Trump literally has physical control over the people who would be used to make these points and to talk to his constituency and to prove to his constituency that he means business. He cannot have these people, as he uses the word, infecting American society. So that's on a propaganda level.
Right.
However, we see very little effective reaction. The Democrats have just, you know, checked out. And we don't see, even in progressive arenas, we see people talking, not doing, but talking. And this is a period in which talking is not enough. You have to put the feet in the street. You have to educate your public. You have to talk about the issues. You have to bring people into the fold. But they're taking, and they have been taking, the convenient way out, which is they don't see how necessary it is to roll up your sleeves and get into the community and do good old-fashioned, you know, proselytizing, if you will. You've got to get the message across. You have to warn people. You have to be in the community. How often is it that we have been talking about these things and the comment usually is, well, we don't see them.
Yes.
We're not hearing from them.
Well, you see, at this point, if I could sum it up this way, I would say people have to understand that they are being played. That's the only way this kind of behavior by the ruling class continues is to play the people, and they are playing them very well, and they're winning, and we are losing.
I agree. No disagreement at all. Thank you very much, David, for contributing today. Jose from Rosedale, how are you?
Greetings, my professor. I am doing fine. And I might add, my personal therapist. So, how are you doing?
I'm hanging in.
Good.
Disappointing. Disappointing many people by hanging in.
Well, you're not disappointing me at all. I hope you live, as my old folks used to say, I hope you live until long enough until they sun you. And that is a long, long time. it's an old Jamaican saying, you know.
What are you teaching us today? What are you teaching us today?
Well, I hope that I'll accomplish something. You know, I heard of the murder of these five journalists.
Yes.
I thought for a moment, I wondered, why did it take so long for these things to happen? Because I see in this age of white supremacy, where they have a standard bearer that is carrying their cause, I expect as we go along that many, I hope I'm wrong, but I expect many more journalists, especially the journalists that don't toe the line of this administration. I expect them to. I'm not saying that the big man is actually going to go and take these folks out, but he has people who believe in his ideology, and I'm sure that they will go out there and do things to journalists that he points out as not doing him justice and producing fake news and all these type of things. Just as how we have had folks from that genre that is blowing up abortion clinics and killing doctors who perform abortion and stuff like that. We have a lot of those folks that belongs to that kind, that fringe of government that are capable and willing to do these things. And I'm afraid that we're going to see more of that type of thing taking place. And also those who that are willing to really stand up and write about some of these things that are happening, the injustices and wrongs of this administration. I'm afraid that many will eventually just they will toe the line and not expose themselves by going after the truth. And that is one of the things I'm afraid of. So I look also at the parallel of this administration to that of Nazi Germany, where this government now have the executive branch, the Congress and the Senate and so forth is in his hands. And now he's going after the judicial. He wants total control of this country. And what is there to stop him to do and implement the kind of laws and of governance that he wants to? For instance, ban peaceful demonstration. Those who go out to demonstrate peacefully, they probably shot upon like the Palestinians who are there peacefully demonstrating on behalf of their existence. I'm sure these are the things that's going to come to this country when we see all power, supreme power, is in the hands of this man, and there are people that he considers undesirable and not worthy of being in this country. Where's to prevent him from creating laws and to ship people out in by shiploads and to send them to parts unknown or wherever he feels like do? What is there? Who's there to stop him? Who's there to stop him from running roughshod all over the African continent and the Caribbean and to implement the kind of laws and ungodly and criminal acts in all these countries? This is what I am afraid of. These are things going through my mind, because it's not something that it is so abstract, so off the wall, that it cannot happen. The man is amassing all the supreme powers that he wants. He wants to be the el numero uno, the leader of this, the world, period. I don't know about free world, but the leader of the world, where he has total control and power over doing whatever he wants to do.
So, Jose, you don't see any possibility of the people exercising some kind of meaningful control or resistance to that?
I'm afraid I have to tell you no. I have not seen it. And the Democrats, they are so passive. And I don't know. I have a funny feeling that one of these days, Trump will unite the Democratic and Republican Party as one. I don't see any mass movement, any challenges to what this man is doing. All the media outlets and so forth, they have given this man they have boosted him and helped him to come to power. And so, as I said, he controls the executive branch. Don't even talk about the Congress and the Senate. They're in his pockets. And the judicial now. And he's going to have the chance to name even one or two more judges. So what's going to happen to folks who don't think like he and his crew and don't look like them?
Okay, so what
I
do you
see,
think?
I see some serious days ahead of my professor.
But these observations that you have made, right? Mm-hmm. You've made some very strong observations.
Mm-hmm.
Are you also saying that there is little hope of an effective opposition to this? Are you giving up hope that it could happen?
You know, I must say this to you. The only thing that I've taken away from that great philosopher, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, keep hope alive. I have never given up hope. I can't. When I give up hope is when I'm under the ground. But still, I can't help but feel disillusioned and hopeless at times. But when I express myself, it's because of the frustration and not seeing the movement, especially from those among us who should know better and should put up help us to put up a credible front to what is happening to us. But all the leadership I find in our community have acquiesced, and many of them will go up there and they will pontificate and say whatever they have to say. Right now, you have so many of them is Trump bashment. I went to, I told you last year, I think it was, I went to a town hall meeting in Brooklyn. And our congresswoman, Yvette Clark, was there. And it was a Trump bashment party. There was no real concrete plan of action. And at this time, anybody Everybody will go to a Trump bashment party. What is the plan? What is the plan of action? Who is going to put their life on the line and stand up with courage to fight on behalf of us, our cause, our people? Everybody, it seems as if the leadership are just acquiesce and just, you know, I don't know what else to say, my professor, but I have not given up hope. And somewhere along the way, well, let's say miracles probably happen, but can still happen. But I'm watching, I'm hoping that some leadership will come from somewhere that we, the conscious amongst, can join that leadership and say, let us at least put up a good fight. I don't see it happening.
Well, I think that that ought to be front and center of a community demand.
Mm-hmm.
That the leadership must be served notice that they have been found wanting in this particular respect,
mm-hmm.
and they are therefore warned or given adequate notice that if they don't get it, we will just have to push them aside and move over them. But their willingness or unwillingness to participate,
mm-hmm.
They will have to be served notice that after a certain point, there will be no further discussion about it.
But it's not being done. When I go to these events, my professor, and I look at what is there, the response from some of these people. I'm going to go parochially and just make a point to you. I might have said to you before, but a few weeks back, I attended a town hall meeting in Queens, right here in Queens. And our guest of honor was none other than the former Prime Minister of Jamaica, right? Bruce Golding. Under this man's administration, there was a massacre of humongous magnitude in Tivoli Gardens, all right? And so many of our people slaughtered. And this is a tent. The 8th anniversary of that slaughter. To this day, not one individual has gained any compensation for the over 200 people that were slaughtered there by black folks with the blood of Africa coursing through their veins, perpetrating this on other black folks. And I was the only one in the town hall meeting that addressed the issue. I asked this man, since this atrocity was committed on our people under his administration, I want him to make a case for us, for me, and for the justice-loving people of the world. Why he and his administration, the members of his administration, shouldn't be dragged before the International Criminal Court of Justice, charged with crimes against humanity, tried and sentenced and sent up the river for a long stretch so that it may act as a deterrent to others who think like him, who would use the power of the state to come down on our people. And no one else in the place followed up on the question. And some of them was actually mad with me for asking this illustrious leader those kind of questions. Because as far as they're concerned, the lives of our people are marginalized. It is not important. It has no value. And how dare me to ask this man who had the right, the supreme right, to kill our people and get away with it. And he had the nerve to respond to me by telling me that there's a fellow in Jamaica by the name of Lloyd D'Aguilar. He tried it, and it didn't work. It didn't succeed. And you sound a little more eloquent and determined. Maybe you can make it happen. And I said to him, so you're giving me an exercise in futility. Because he's actually mocking me, he's disrespecting me, and showing me his arrogance. And nobody in that place was mad enough and insulted enough to follow through and demand that this man, let us have this discuss this issue. And this is what we're dealing with. Our people has become so passive that they have accepted everything that's thrown at us. There's a time we used to just bend over backwards. Now we're also bending over forwards. So it,
you know,
it,
Mark,
it, it,
this
it
all that you have
me.
Said and all that you are saying, I hate to say it,
yes.
but it is to be expected. It is not to be a surprise. It is to be expected. Before you even went there,
yes,
you probably knew in your mind
sure.
that that's what the reaction was going to be.
Sure, sure.
So that's my point. My point is that you didn't have to wait to actually go through the actual experience of it to see how it unfolded, and it unfolded as predictably as you might have conceived it in your mind.
Yes,
but this
yes.
is part of political activity.
But how do
you
we get the people now to wake up and understand that their interest is at stake? And we cannot
yes,
go on like
but
this.
We want people to wake up. But guess what? We also have to expect, we also have to accept certain realities. That is not done simply by wanting it to happen. It is also a process. I mean, when more than 200 people are killed in an assault coordinated with police and the state, and it did not serve to send a message to people that the order that they think that they're enjoying is really not order at all. It's the state collaborating with elements even within the society that they would not agree with. I keep asking, how did Bruce Golding end up with a yacht?
Oh, people will not ask those questions. Those are the type of questions that they will not ask.
Right, but so the idea is, you got to know what you're dealing with, and you have to understand that. When you start taking these things on, your life is on the line.
Sure.
There are not going to be many people standing next to you, agreeing with you and walking with you. It's not going to happen.
Sure.
So we have to find other ways of reaching people. In Tivoli Gardens, as you know, it's a stronghold of major drug dealers. They're the ones controlling Tivoli Gardens, not you and other law-abiding people. No, it's a totally corrupt process.
The whole entire system is corrupt.
The people have been denied for so long that whoever pays them the kind of attention that they've not gotten for so long, those are the people that they will be loyal to.
But if you cannot reach the people with the truth, it's the truth you're giving the people. You can't reach them with the truth. Then what else are you, what are you going to reach them with?
Well, you have it's a process. It's not an easy answer. It's a process.
I thought
and
you had to answer my professor.
you have to just stay the course and do what you can.
I can't give up. I can't.
Some kind of tactic that might work. But I understand how passionate you are about it, because any person who can read the tea leaves, as it were, could see where this is going. And they know that the outcome will not at all be in favor of the people. But this is... Bruce Golding has basically presided over the formation of a narco state.
Which they
and
all
that's
and benefit
Jamaica.
From.
And that's what's running Jamaica.
And you know, lastly, he has been appointed by the present prime minister of the same party, and you know they are in the same boat together. He has been appointed as a big man to do a job on CARICOM. He's going to study the relevance of CARICOM to Jamaica. and so on and so. So he's got a big plush job, I guess, with staff and all kind of stipends and salary and so forth, and living a large life. And so he's being sanitized and cleaned up, I guess, to make another return down the road someplace. And this is the kind of game that's being played on our people. As a brother said before, we have been played. We have been had. We have been snookered. And it's just something that I think too many of our people look forward to being had, taken, snookered. I don't know. Well.
Bruce Golding's job is actually
the pearly gate
to help dismantle CARICOM,
yes,
so that literally nothing will stand in the way of the narco states of the Caribbean doing whatever it is they want to do.
Yes.
Thanks so much for calling, Jose.
Thank you, Mike.
Always learning something.
May the God of our ancestors continue to bless you always.
Thank you so much for that. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful you, Trees.
Hey, wonderful Harvey. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, today I'd like to talk about the dangers of nuclear energy. And America's nuclear plants are, first of all, are grid-tied. Nuclear power plants need to be tied to our nation's power grid to supply electricity to run the nuclear plant's control room, the water pumps that circulate water around the reactors, and keeps the spent fuel water pools circulating water to keep them from being uncovered and catching on fire. And if the electric grid fails due to a mass coronal ejection from the sun or a cyber attack, there are on-site electric generators that can supply power to the nuclear plants for about a week or two. But if they cannot restore the power in time due to overloaded transformers, broken transformers, America will experience a nationwide Fukushima-like meltdown across America. Number two, the big lie is that nuclear plants generate clean or carbon-free electricity. And besides the carbon produced by mining, transportation, refining, storage, guarding, of nuclear materials, it turns out that a lot of the electric grid that supplies electricity to America's power plants is fossil fuel powered. And here in California, the grid is over 50% fossil fuel driven. We know that fossil fuels are a major source of CO2 in our atmosphere. So the fact that nuclear plants are carbon free is an outright lie. And number three, nuclear plants are notorious for killing vast amounts of aquatic life. Right here in California, the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant pumps about 2.5 billion, that's with a B, gallons of water a day to keep the two reactors cool. And this has been going on day after day for over 50 years, killing aquatic life, including trillions of fish larvae, and severely reducing America's marine food supply potential. And number four, water vapor that is produced is a major greenhouse gas. Nuclear power plant cooling towers emit vast amounts of water vapor into our atmosphere, and the hot water released by power plants into the ocean warm up the ocean by about 20 degrees. And we're talking over 100 nuclear plants, and the one here in California pumps 2.5 billion gallons a day. So we're talking about a lot of hot water and a lot of water vapor into the atmosphere. So I say that solar is safe nuclear. The sun is a nuclear reactor that's 73 million miles away, and the solar panels pick up the sun's radiation and turn it into safe, clean, renewable electricity. So I say it's time to get star powered. Let's get solar.
I agree. You know, we've been talking lately, and we're going to be doing some more discussion about the state of America's nuclear infrastructure. Tom Carpenter was with us, and this is also a direct result of a series that Paul DiRienzo had done with us, talking about the Hanford site and the sad state of affairs when it comes to the deterioration of America's nuclear plants. And now they're trying to move into another phase without first paying attention to the first phase, which is, what do you do about nuclear waste? I will be talking very shortly. We're just trying to get the logistics right of a representative of the Diné nation, and she tells a horrible story about what the government has been doing, especially on the lands of the First Nations people, in trying to bury nuclear waste on their lands without care as to the safety of the containers and so forth, and the poisoning of the water tables. It's an awful story, but we'll be talking about that soon too. But your point is well taken. In the meantime, people are looking at ways to contain the damage already done, but your point is absolutely well taken, that it should include, we should have an aggressive program to head off the awful consequences which we've already experienced and which would last for several lifetimes. We really need to pay attention to that. So thank you very much, Harvey. When you give us information about the dangers of an unregulated nuclear industry, this is what we are facing. Thank you so much for your call. Jeff from New Jersey, you have a short time, but you're on the air.
All right. Well, I want to start with, you know, the gentleman, two callers before, the Jamaican, listen,
Jose.
You have 200 families. Yeah, Jose. You have 200 families that were affected by 200 people getting killed. You start with them because from those families, things will multiply. Each family may have 10 members, and now you have 2,000 people. But you have to start with the victims first. Start small. Everything that we need to do right now is start small. You turn off your computers, you go to the library, and you get books. All right? You have children read books. You teach them how to plant seeds and grow a plant. I don't care if you're in Brooklyn. I don't care if you're in Queens. You teach them the value of nature, because they're going to be the ones that will help to figure out how to help climate change. They're going to be the ones that's going to figure out how to get to denuclearize our planet, right? But they would do that only because they care about nature, and that they understand nature, and they understand the cycle that we're all in, and that we, you know, bugs feed the dirt, dirt feed the plants feed us, right? Next thing is, you know, we all need to take a personal responsibility about things. If we don't,
but you know, I want to say this. I do not disagree with your idea, but I'm saying that you have to literally go into the environment to appreciate how distorted it currently is. And distortion is what is the order of the day. There's no logic to life in certain parts of our universe. Life is lived under entirely different terms and circumstances that make no sense and will make no sense to people who don't understand what is happening there.
Well, the one
there
thing
are entire towns and villages all over the world that have been taken over by the drug lords. You can't go in there and start talking about education and getting, you know, people to grow their own crops. They're not interested in that. And they will see that as a direct threat. You can't begin to talk logic to these folks. Their minds have gone away from them. And they're living in a parallel universe which would take us quite a bit of time to understand. That's the issue of a narco state. I was born in Trinidad. I would, you know, one would think that, well, I know Trinidad. I don't know Trinidad today. I know what's going on, and it is so different from anything that I've known. You see? So it's a whole different reality, a whole different set of rules, a whole different kind of leadership that is controlling pockets all over the world. That you can't imagine how distorted life is in those areas, but it is.
Yeah, well, I would have a quote for the gentleman, just something to think about, because I know, you know, they said it's very hard to educate or even change the mind because it's a threat. But the point should be made that today's surveillance state, that narco thing is not going to last. All they're waiting for them to do is to kill off their allies, who could be allies, and then walk in and take whatever they want. Because they're using, just like in Africa, when you have two different tribes fighting each other, committing genocide. Well, that person that you just killed is your ally. Now, people from the north can walk in and take whatever you want because you don't have the numbers anymore. And that's exactly why the division, why the drugs are put down there, why those things are done. The other thing is, you got to march and put your life on the line. You know, you got to, if that's the situation, you gotta get out. But they will have to understand that, everything that they do is already recorded. And when they want to come for them and take them out, it's already done. You know, they'll blow them up on the spot. Their reign is not going to last forever. And the other thing is very interesting. Tony Brown said, and he said it about arresting drug dealers. And, as the drug dealers got younger and younger, we put the younger and younger people in jail. Let them get old. Let the drug dealer get old. Because if you arrest him, you create a job opportunity for a younger person to step into that role. But if you allow them to stay where they are, young people have to find other ways to raise money. And if that's what needs to be done, to allow, sometimes, and I'm saying that in the broad sense where perhaps it's not the best idea to fight them at this time, but to allow them to do what they do, because as long as they're doing it, no one else can step up behind them.
The thing is that it breeds a level of chaos that is not easily corrected, and that becomes the norm. And that spells the destruction of the whole society. The way it is going now, people seem to think, well, it's not a good way to operate, but at least we know where they are. And we'll give them power and influence over that little pocket. But that's really not the way the narco state operates. The money is not confined to one little area. The drug activity is not confined to one little area. It is the whole country and the whole world. So when you yield, and many people don't have any choice but to yield, many small countries to fight these people, they just don't have the personnel, they don't have the equipment, they don't even have the will to take them on. They concede immediately. So we have a domino effect of successive societies falling prey to this kind of way of living that is completely alien to most people. But they are hostages of it just the same. Thank you, Jeff. I just heard a little hint in the background that the music is on, so that means our time is up. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You could always learn something from him. And have yourselves a very meaningful and restful weekend. And surround yourselves with very positive people. And we'll see each other on Monday. Thanks so much for your participation and your contributions today. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.